This is Live at Politics and Prose, a program from Slate and Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C., featuring some of today's best writers and top thinkers.
You know, wars, for all their suffering and destruction, have over the ages had the virtue of inspiring some really great literature. And the recent U.S. experience is proving no exception. But so far, as an article in the Los Angeles Times pointed out a few months ago, almost all the new war literature has come from Iraq. The Afghan War has produced many memoirs and lots of other nonfiction by veterans, but hardly any notable novels until now. Several reasons have been offered for this lack of fiction from the Afghan War up to now. Americans largely lost interest in Afghanistan after the toppling of the Taliban regime in 2001 and turned their attention to Iraq. The Afghan victory had looked relatively easy and uncomplicated, at least initially, while Iraq was a bigger, more controversial war. There was also, after a while, more deep, brooding dissatisfaction with Iraq, more despair and a sense of futility about it. And that's, of course, fertile ground for novelists. Elliot Ackerman's new book, Green on Blue, is set in Afghanistan and so stands out from other recent war novels. It also departs from much of the modern war writing that's been done by other veterans, in that the story is told not in the voice of an American soldier, but from the vantage of an impoverished Afghan soldier who rather haplessly gets swept up in the deadly conflict engulfing his country. He and other principal characters must survive the violence and political complications of contemporary Afghanistan by making difficult, often compromising choices. Elliot was able to write about the Afghan War from a different vantage point because over the course of 8 years, as both a Marine and a CIA officer, he was deployed multiple times and saw the wars in both Afghanistan and Iraq from various perspectives. As a Marine Corps infantry officer, he led a rifle platoon during the Second Battle for Fallujah in 2004. Later, as a special operations officer in the Marine Corps, he advised an Afghan commando battalion. And after 5 years in the Marines, he spent a couple of years in the CIA as a paramilitary case officer. His military awards include the Silver Star, Bronze Star for Valor, and the Purple Heart. In his book, Elliot takes a rather small story and uses it movingly to address such big issues as family, revenge, honor, and betrayal. The lines between right and wrong, between good guys and bad guys, end up very blurred. Early reviews of Green on Blue have used terms such as powerful, haunting, lyrical, and poignant to describe the book. Just check out today's New York Times, where Michiko Kakutani commends Elliot for having done a remarkable job and praises his breadth of understanding, not just of the rhythms and hardships of war, but of the toll that seemingly endless battles have taken on ordinary Afghans. Although Elliot is now out of the military and the CIA, he's still not done with war. He currently lives in Turkey, writing about the war in Syria for several publications. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Elliot Ackerman.
Thank you. My wife might say I am done with war, so we'll have to dispute that later. And thanks so much to Politics and Prose for hosting this event, and thank you all for coming out. You know, I guess they say this is the book's launch, so you always remember the people who came to the novel's launch, but you doubly remember the people who braved a hellacious snowstorm to come to the novel's launch. So thank you all for being here. I thought I'll talk a little bit and then read a little bit, but you know, I guess because it's the first day of the novel, it would be worthwhile starting at the beginning. And driving over here, you know, I was sort of, you know, I've been thinking, like, you know, when did this book actually start? And, you know, I've often gone back to an anecdote when I was an advisor to Afghan troops. And I advised this one guy. His name was Isak. And he was rugged Tajik tribal leader, led about 200 Afghan paramilitaries. And about every 2 weeks, Isak and I would sit down, as we would always do, and we would kind of loaf down on this sofa in his office. And his office was sort of a bare room. And on the wall, there was a map. And there was a calendar. And we would sit there, lots of chai, lots of cigarettes. And Isak, I'd look at Isak and say, Isak, we're looking at the map and the calendar. All right, we got 2 weeks and we're heading out on patrol. Where do you want to go? And Isak would sort of rub his face, sip his chai, smoke his cigarette, and maybe he'd point to a village and say, we should go up to Mangrate, Mr. Elliot. There's always very good hunting up in Mangrate. So, we'd block that out on the calendar, maybe it'd be 5 days, and we would drive our way up to Mangrate, and 50-50 chance we'd get in a little fight on the way up to Mangrate. We'd come back down, we'd clean up our trucks for a few days, we'd rest, and then it'd be 2 weeks later, we'd be back in that office, lots of chai, lots of cigarettes, looking at the calendar and the map, and Isak would kind of rub his chin and say, Mr. Elliot, we could go to Rarakore. It's always good hunting up in Rarakore. And so we get in our trucks and we go up to Rarakore. I thought a lot about those meetings over the years, me and Isak sitting there in that room. And the conversation was never something like, Mr. Elliot, if we hit them in Malakshe and then we push down to Rarakore, we can block them off in Mangrate. The war will be over. I can go back to raising my crops. You and your friends can all go to business school, and we'll all live our lives. It wasn't that type of war. Isak fought for his reasons because his position, gave him a lot of clout and wast as a tribal leader. And I fought for my reasons that it had become my career, my identity, my job. It was what I did, and my friends did. So. I start asking a lot of questions. Well, if it wasn't that type of war, like a Second World War or something with, a victory at the end of it, what type of war was it? And, I started exploring that in my writing and my fiction. And I think, the outcome is the novel Green on Blue. So what I'd like to do is just read to you a little bit from, it's the first night of the book's launch. Might as well start at the beginning. Many would call me a dishonest man, but I've always kept faith with myself. There is an honesty in that, I think. I am Ali's brother. We are from a village that no longer exists, and our family was not large or prosperous. The war that came after the Russians, but before the Americans, killed our parents. Of them, I have only dim memories. There is my father's Kalashnikov, hidden in a woodpile by the door. Him cleaning it, working oiled rags on its parts, and the smell of gunmetal, and feeling safe. There is my mother's secret, the one she shared with me. Once a month, she'd count out my father's earnings from fighting in the mountains or farming. She'd send me and Ali from our village, Sperkai, to the large bazaar in Orgun, a 2-day walk. The Orgun bazaar sold everything, fine cooking oils and spices, candles to light our home, and fabrics to repair our clothes. My mother always entrusted me with a special purpose. Before we left, she would press an extra coin in my hand, one she'd stolen from my father. Among the crowded stalls of the bazaar, I would slip away from my brother's watchful eye and buy her a pack of cigarettes, a vice forbidden to a woman. When we returned home, I would place the pack in her hiding spot, the birchwood cradle where she'd rocked Ali and me as infants. Our mud-walled house was small, 2 thatch-roofed rooms with a courtyard between them. The cradle was kept in the room I shared with Ali. My mother would never get rid of the cradle. It was the one thing that was truly hers. At night, after we returned from the bazaar, she'd sneak into our room, her small, sandaled feet gliding across the carpets that lined the dirt floor. Her hand would cup a candle, its smothered light casting shadows on her young face, aging her. Her eyes, one brown and the other green, a miracle or defect of birth, shifted about the room. Carefully, she would lean over the cradle, as she'd done before taking us to nurse. She would run her fingers between the blankets that once swaddled my brother and me. And, finding the pack I'd left her, she'd step into the courtyard, and I'd fall back asleep to the faint smell of her tobacco just past my door. This secret made me feel close to my mother. In the years since, I've wondered why she entrusted me with it. At times, I've thought it was because I was her favorite. But this isn't why. The truth is, she recognized in me her own ability to deceive. So that is sort of the opening refrain of the book. You know, many people would call me a dishonest man, but I've always kept faith with myself. There's an honesty in that, I think. And, you know, when I was sort of starting to conceptualize this book, which, again, as I said, was a kind of a rendering of, you know, what Afghanistan was, you know, my ambition in many ways was to try to show the war in miniature. You know, Aziz, the protagonist of this book, is an Afghan soldier. You know, he fights in what's called the Special Lashkar, which is an amalgam of, you know, many multi-named Afghan sort of commando border guard units that exist there. There's one commander, a guy named Commander Sabir, in the book. There's one outpost. You know, there's one village called Gamal that these guys are ultimately fighting over. So, in, you know, sitting there trying to figure out how do I tell this war in miniature, you know, sometimes the book kind of writes itself. So when I started, I had this very clear concept of how it sounded. And the way it sounded to me was I spent a lot of my career in special operations doing intelligence work, which equates to a lot of time, you know, sitting in a plywood hut with a bunch of Afghans who you think might have some information that you need, but you're not really sure. And, you know, you kind of were hoping that you were going to get to watch the movie tonight, but this guy really wants to talk and he's very interested in eating the peanut M&Ms you brought and drinking Coke with you. You know, so it's a lot of time just sitting there talking with Afghans, trying to like get at their story. And, you know, and every now and again, you know, some would show up with something that, you know, that was really worthwhile. So the construct of the book initially for me was, it was this exchange. It was like a debriefing. It was an Afghan telling his story to who? And at first it was sort of to me. And there was a character in the book who was basically a case officer. The entire construct of the book was basically told through a debriefing in multiple chapters. And as I got through subsequent drafts and a few people read the book and gave me advice, I actually kind of came to realize, like, why did I have to have that framework in the book? This book is not about this American case officer. This book is about the Afghan. And I realized I put that framework in place because, frankly, I, at that moment, didn't have the courage to let the book stand or fall on the merits of the voice of the Afghan. You know, and we'll see in subsequent weeks whether or not that worked. But but that's sort of how I arrived at this character of Aziz. So what I'd like to do is just read you a little bit more that will give you a sense of the book's opening. After that, after those first few initial paragraphs when Aziz is describing how he's raised, you come to find out that both of his parents are killed in the time between the war with the Soviets and the when the Americans come, so during the Taliban days. And then he and his brother, his older brother Ali, takes him to the nearest sort of major city, which is a small city called Orgun in southeastern Afghanistan. And his brother, basically, they wind up living kind of on the streets in Orgun, and they start to find their way and start to create a small livelihood for themselves. So it started with a wheelbarrow. Ali found it in a ravine and began to haul me around Orgun in it. Its empty front tire flapped against the dust and announced our arrival with every bump. I rode in the scoop and played the cripple. I'd droop my arms, hide my legs beneath the canvas sack as if I had none, and breathe heavily through an open mouth. Along the streets, Ali would shout, "Zagat for my brother! Charity for my poor cripple of a brother!" 5 times a day, after the faithful finished namaz, Ali would wheel me to one of the city's mosques. The mullahs often passed out scraps of food, some naan or a bowl of plain rice. The wealthy pray less than the poor, so we begged for change in the bazaar. Here Ali would struggle to hold the wheelbarrow upright as the crowds pressed against it. Beside the heaps of scrap metal, stacks of lumber, and sacks of pistachios and pomegranates, merchants shouted their prices into the street. Ali's voice mixed with the merchants as he cried out for zakat, and I slumped in the wheelbarrow playing my part. Mostly we were ignored or shooed away, but from time to time a coin would be pressed into my brother's palm, just as my mother once pressed one into mine. After a few hours begging, my legs would begin to ache. Ali would wheel me down an alley behind the mud-walled stalls of the bazaar. It was soggy and brown, and an open sewer ran the length of it. Out of view, I could stretch. We didn't earn much, but now, when it snowed, we had enough for a few days' stay in a tea house. This is how we survived our third winter. One day, as we returned to the bazaar, a grocer named Rafi John confronted us. He had a thick black beard and a round, hard stomach. Long ago, we'd learned to avoid his stall. Under his arm, he carried a large sack of rice. He looked down his pointed nose at us and shouted, "Here's your zakat, boy." He dropped the sack on me. Its weight knocked over the wheelbarrow. My legs shot straight out before I landed in a heap on the dirt floor. Merchants stepped from behind their stalls, and shoppers gathered around me. "This boy is no cripple," announced Rafi John to the crowd. A wave of laughter rose up through the bazaar. Shame made my stomach crumple like paper, and I fought my desire to cry. Even a boy can lose his nang, his honor. I pulled myself up from the dust of the road, and as I did, Ali ran past. Rafi John continued to laugh, blinded by his own fat hilarity, the huge mass of his stomach lifting. Ali threw his fist into Rafi John's groin. The merchant's laughter choked, and he fell onto his side, the dust settling onto the perfect blackness of his beard. "Hanzir," Ali screamed over him. "Next time I'll kill you." A silence fell over the bazaar. Then, one by one, the merchants laughed harder than before. While Rafi John lay there, his nang in the dirt, another merchant approached us. He wore plain clothes, a serious face, and carried a heap of twisted branches in his arms. He introduced himself as Hamza. "You understand how to defend your brother's nang," he said to Ali. "You know something of Pashtunwali that is all too rare in these days. I could use a young man like you. Untangle these branches and deliver them as kindling to the Rishkor tea house. You know the one?" Ali nodded. "We'd stayed there once. It was far away on the north side of the city." "Good," said Hamza. "This will be yours when you return." He held up a 500 Afghani note, enough for a day's food. We sorted the wood into piles and lashed bundles of each. It took us nearly an hour to get to the tea house and the same to return. By this time, the stalls of the bazaar were closed, but Hamza was still there, rocking back on two legs of a worn wooden stool. When he saw us, he reached into the shirt pocket of his baggy shawar kameez. Pinched between his fingers was the 500 Afghani note. Ali snatched it from Hamza. Holding the note, my brother put his eyes to the ground, ashamed by his desperation. "I need someone to watch my shop tonight," said Hamza. "If you boys do that, others will likely have business for you in the morning." "You would trust us with your shop?" asked Ali. "I ask no man to trust me, and I trust no one. Trust is a burden one puts on another." Then he spoke the proverb, "But he is my friend that grinds at my mill." Hamza left us two blankets and an oil lamp. We wrapped ourselves in them and placed the lamp between us. Our blankets smelled of straw and dirt, the lamp of diesel. It was warm inside the stall, and we slept. In the morning, there was work. The other merchants agreed it was difficult to find someone who'd make an honest delivery for a 500 Afghani note. All through that winter and the following seasons, Ali and I hauled goods to and from the bazaar. Flour to the bakers, bolts of fabric to the tailors. We stacked our wheelbarrow's loads so its height often exceeded our own. We'd soon earned enough money to buy a handcart or even a mule, but Ali refused to spend it. Instead, he saved every coin, and at the end of each day, the last merchant to close up would let us sleep on the dirt floor of his shop. The next fall was our fourth away from home. This is when the Americans came. The militants in Orgun hid in the border mountains. At night, they'd return. Some were Haqqanis, I think, but most now called themselves Taliban. A few were honorable men who practiced Pashtunwali, but many did as they pleased, taking what they wanted from homes and shops. We heard stories of far greater crimes outside Orgun. Militants accused men of being informants and beheaded them in front of their families. Americans accused men of being militants and disappeared them in the night on helicopters. The militants fought to protect us from the Americans, and the Americans fought to protect us from the militants. And, being so protected, life was very dangerous. Those who came to the market from smaller, far-off villages spoke of gun battles and bombings. We learned the names of commanders such as Sabir, Hafez, and later Ghazan. They fought on all sides and lived with us like shadows, like those of the boys we'd once slept beside in the mountains. The merchants in the bazaar picked no side. The politics of their war never changed. Survival. Ali and I continued to make deliveries. We also gave the merchants a watchful set of eyes at night. For this we were valued, and that seemed very good. One night, more than a year after Ali punched Rafi John, now one of our best customers, my brother said he had a gift for me. I asked him what it was, but he would tell me nothing. Instead, he turned down the flame of the oil lamp that sat between us on the floor. The room grew dark, and he held his finger to the sky as he spoke. "Look there, Aziz. What do you see?" "Father's ring," I said. The ring shone in the dim lamplight, and I thought perhaps he would give it to me. "Car, donkey," Ali snapped and clapped me on the back of the head. "I point at the moon and you stare at my finger. Do you see the moon there?" I looked past his finger and through a small shuttered window. "Yes," I said, "I see it. And what do you know of it?" "It is a half moon tonight." "Do you know why?" Ali asked. "No, no," he repeated. "Do you feel any shame that you don't know?" "You don't know either," I reminded him. "You're right," he said, "I don't. But I feel shame because of it." Between us, it became quiet. "And this, father's ring," he said. "How would you replace it if it were lost?" "I would never lose it." "Someday it will be lost," he said. "And if we haven't learned to replace it, the loss will be complete." "If you give it to me," I said, "it will never be lost. I very much wanted the ring." Ali shook his head and spoke. "That is what those fools in the mountains say. Give it all to me, and it will never be lost. They create nothing, and so the little over which they fight is already lost. You will learn another way. I've been saving our money so you might start at the madrasa." "Well, who will help you with work?" I asked, hurt by Ali's wish to be without me. "That is my burden now," he said. "Your burden is to be educated. It's what father wanted for me. It's what I can give you, to make something new." "I won't abandon you," I said. "To not go, you abandon me." These last words, he spoke the strongest of all. Thank you. So I think how this works is if anybody has questions, we could do questions, and they ask by pain of death or exile into the snow that you use the microphones. Missy Ryan in the back.
Thanks, Ali. It's great to be here. I was curious why you also served in Iraq, and I'm curious what drew you to write about the war in Afghanistan versus Iraq. Was it the nature of the different roles that you had there, or was it something about the conflict in Afghanistan itself?
Sure. You assume I haven't written about Iraq. I've done some writing. You know, I do, you know, magazine writing and nonfiction. Right. I've written about Iraq, too.
Sure.
I do think, what's happening right now, particularly among vets who are writing in literature, I think it's very interesting to see the difference of the work that's coming out that's based in Afghanistan versus what's coming out of Iraq. Mm-hmm. I think that the Iraq narrative actually lends itself to a much more recognizable storyline. You know, we have a war that many people feel was sort of fought on shaky ground. There's a lot more, I think, of a narrative around the war that it was waste. And there's this sort of, if you look at the writing that's come out of Iraq, it's, you know, for the most part, it kind of tends to be very ironic, tends to be very elegiac. And I think that follows in a much longer tradition of war writing back to, you know, the stuff that came out of the Vietnam War, all the way back to the work that came out of the First World War. I think what's interesting in Afghanistan is that, you know, you don't really have those components in it. So you, I mean, regardless of how you feel the war is gone, like the casus belli was pretty righteous. You know, I remember where I was on 9/11. And it kind of, I think, leads to lots of many layers of complexity that you don't necessarily see, not that you don't see in the other literature, but it's just, it doesn't follow it as neatly into a tradition. So that's not the reason why I chose to write about Afghanistan, but I think it's something that's going to be kind of exciting that will come out of the literature in Afghanistan. But who knows? There's great stuff coming out about both wars, and there are a lot of people who are writing who have experience and interest of both those wars.
Thank you.
Oh. Elliot. Oh, sorry. Hi.
Elliot, this narrative really sounds alive and like it's real. I can really feel it. But but it feels like it's someone who I know. That is the kind of language that that I understand, and I'm wondering if you had a struggle with that, in that their language has to be very different. The construct of the sentences, the way they're thinking, the way that they would approach a problem. Maybe backwards. And I'm wondering if you struggled with that part of the narrative.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think I was having drinks probably a couple months ago with a friend of mine who's also a novelist, and we were sort of talking, and I was talking to him about the book, and he's like, so what language is the book in? I was like, what do you mean? He's like, well, you've got Americans, I'm like, huh. I was like, well, I guess the entire book is in Pashto. He's like, yeah, good luck with that. So, but as I'm writing the book, I realize that everything that's going on in the book is in Pashto. So when there's only one American character in the book, but when he enters, suddenly kind of his voice is actually very different, because he is an American speaking Pashto. So there's a line later in the book where he says, he spoke Pashto like a child. And when he speaks, he actually sounds a little bit like a child, because although he's speaking in English, the English is the Pashto in this book. So it's sort of, as a writer, kept you on your toes. And anytime I would have tendencies to maybe get a little bit, whoopity-doo and fancy-pantsy in the prose, I definitely would need to rein myself back and try to be as disciplined as I could, as channeling. It's like, this is Aziz's voice. Everything here has to filter through Aziz's voice, and it has to be interesting. So yes, voice in the language was very much on my mind.
Hey, Elliot. So it reminds me a bit of Carter Malkasian. Malkasian, or how do we pronounce Carter?
Malkasian.
State Department, 2009, 2011, who really did embrace the Afghans, lived and worked with the Afghans. And in your work, your sensibility, entering that world of the Afghans, did you find pushback from any of the American service members in choosing to tell this book? Because it's a brave prism to look at it through the Afghan point of view. Did you get any pushback from American military?
No, but the book comes out tomorrow.
Well, bravo. It's a brave. It is a really brave feat.
But if I do, I'm going to send them to you.
I have a feeling that there's much in the sentiment of this book tied in with why you became a Marine. I was wondering if you might talk about that.
Sure. I don't know if it's completely rooted in why, I guess I joined the Marines in 1998 when I went off to college and joined ROTC. But I think, the desire to write the book was, it came from a lot of places. One place it came is, when you go off to war and it's over, you realize you've had this very intense experience. It's a defining experience. And the obvious place that you go to as a veteran, to understand that defining experience is, the other vets you were there with. Like, that's very obvious, and you all reflect on what that experience meant to you all. But as you're doing and you're processing it, you realize you had this extremely intimate experience, but there's another side to the coin, and it's the people you fought against. And they're out there, and they are as much defined by you as you are defined by them. There's a great poem by Yeats I really love. It's called Irish Airman Foresees His Death. It's from the First World War. And it opens, I know that I shall meet my fate somewhere amongst the clouds above. Those I fight, I do not hate. Those I guard, I do not love. And I think, to me, what Yeats is getting at there is this idea that, you know, once the war's over, once all the, you know, anger has dissipated from it, once the causes kind of cease to have their meaning, you know, once we kind of all become old men and the experience is almost distilled down to just what it was, the experience, you know, you realize you weren't dancing by yourself. There was someone on the other side. You know, who are those people? And I wanted to know who they were, and I wanted to imagine what it was like in some ways to be one of them. And maybe in some ways, I like to think that's almost an act of reconciliation.
It must have been very difficult as a former military officer mm-hmm. to really get under the skin of particularly kids mm-hmm. in Afghanistan. I mean, you worked as a special office, mm-hmm. ops officer with many Afghans, but that's a whole different level. Tell us a little bit about what motivated you to write about people starting as kids and how you were able to do that, which must have been, I think, quite difficult.
Sure. I think anyone who's I think anyone who's interested in literature and interested in writing is interested in exploring the ways that we're similar as opposed to the ways that we're different. And so, the ways that we're similar instead of the ways that we're different. And, so when it comes to kids, I was just, I believe that Afghan kids are actually not, in my experiences, they're not that much different than American kids. And when I'm thinking about two young brothers, you know, I have a brother. And I saw, I saw a lot of Afghans and what their familiar relations were like and how close those were. And so it was just really this act of imagination to put myself in their shoes and to try to get underneath their skin. So, I think if I had always focused on how we were different, I wouldn't have made much progress. But for me, all the progress was in finding the similarities. And so I think really holding on to those similarities was what allowed me to make progress in the book.
Hi, Elliot. I want to concentrate on the writing process. So mm-hmm. Do you want to now, be a writer? Is that your, do you think you'll go on to other books? And what is your method of writing? Is it very intense? So it's, some are very disciplined. They get up at 4 in the morning and they mm-hmm. write for 3 hours, take a break and write mm-hmm. some more. Or does it come in stages?
Sure. If I'm working on a manuscript, I kind of do word count every day, and I'll have an idea of where it's going, and mm-hmm. I'll just, I think it's very important to just write to the end and then look back and, judge the mess that you made and then try to fix it up and revise and revise and revise and revise. Mm-hmm. So I find myself being pretty disciplined about it. That's probably based on my background, and that's sort of how I like to attack problems. But everyone, I think, has their own process.
How did your military training impact your writing process, do you think?
I think one thing about the process of writing a book is that writing anything, you really need to suspend belief that it's gonna, or just, suspend disbelief that it's gonna work out. You just sort of, if you think of all the ways it can go wrong and on the entire project, its entirety, you're never gonna make any progress. And so I've found in anything, whether it was being in the military or going through college, I think that it's just, the amazing effect of, sort of the Chinese water torture approach to getting something done. Just like a drop a day. Like I'll move a mountain with a drop a day. So, I've learned that very early on. And, I think it's worked out well.
Thanks very much, Elliot, for this work. A lot of the questions have had to do with your military background and how you drew on that, like this last one. I'm just curious to know more about your personal background and how you on what from that you drew to write.
Sure. My mom is here. Yeah.
That was a softball for her.
Thank you. Yeah, my mom is here. My mother is a novelist. So I think for some people, it seems like this, you know, huge jump that someone who was, you know, that people in the military would get out and necessarily write fiction. And it's funny, a buddy of mine who is also a writer was telling me he was having a conversation with his agent about a book he was pitching. And the book, you know, was sort of about the wars. And the agent just looked at him and he's like, God damn it. I mean, you Iraq and Afghan veterans just need to stop being so literary. which I never really thought of. But so, you know, my mother was a novelist. I went to Tufts. I studied history and English. One of my freshman English teachers was Andre Debuse, who wrote The House of Fan and Fog, who's become a great mentor. I mean, you know, so it's not there's not a huge gulf here. I mean, there's a really proud tradition of this, as was alluded to before, you know, of people going to war and writing about war. I mean, I think if you look at it, it's like almost all literature, it's either like a love story or a war story. So, so you pick. So again, so I think in my personal life, it always seemed like something very natural to do. I had these experiences. I knew I would likely eventually write about them. While I was having them, it didn't seem plausible to write about them. But the first bit of fiction that I wrote, I actually wrote in Afghanistan, and it was on my last deployment. And I mean, it almost sounds trite saying this. I started writing it the day after I decided I was going to leave, and that was going to be my last deployment. I sat down and decided I was going to try to write something about everything that had happened the last 8 years. And it was just, you know, it's not a scene in this book. It was just a scene, and I just wrote the scene. And then it kind of started going from there.
Like many people, I read obsessively all the books that are coming out of Iraq and Afghanistan, and my experience during the Vietnam War is really coloring that for me. But a lot of the writing has been about what a catastrophe this was, both on the people there and post-traumatic stress. And I mean, they're horror stories. And it sounds like you're trying something very different, which is to write an intimate story about, as you were saying, people who are living this every day. Implicit in that is accepting this as the given circumstances. Mm-hmm. This is where we are, and this is where we're going to be, maybe.
Right.
So I guess I would ask you, as someone who's been so intimately involved in this for many years, do you see this as... I mean, it feels like we've moved out of one Cold War into another ongoing forever war, like George Orwell, you know, people mm-hmm. are always going to be fighting. And I'm wondering if that's how do you see our involvement?
Yeah, I think with the wars, I do see that there is a state of perpetual war that exists, but I see it much less in the political and more in the human condition. I mean, I think there's the famous, or I think it's often been said that, you know, in some ways, being against war is like being against hurricanes, because it's just hardwired into the human condition that this is something that we do. You know, I have a lot of conflicting emotions about my war experience. You know, on the one hand, you know, I think a lot of the war writing is deeply elegiac, and it can be very ironic at times. But if I'm being honest in my writing, I also have to be honest in the fact that if you were to take me and set me, you know, 10 years ago today when I was in Iraq, and you were to ask any of the guys I was with, what's the thing you're the most afraid of? They would look, guaranteed to a T, they would look at you and say, I'm really worried that like the next big firefight's going to happen and I'm not going to be there. Like I'll be out, you know, on, you know, guard duty somewhere that I'm going to miss it. Like, and if I want to write honestly about it, I have to get my arms around those emotions. Now, those are like very complex emotions. And then when you come home and this is something you chose, particularly for these wars, because everyone in these wars was a volunteer. And for most of the people and the guys who were in, like, you know, the front line, the infantry, you know, the infantry units that were doing the, you know, the heavier fighting, or were going back, you know, they were going back for multiple deployments. It's something they always chose. Now, it doesn't mean it was always a positive choice. It's a very complex choice on a lot of levels. But sometimes I think the, just sort of the, you know, all war writing is anti-war writing. You know, you can't tell a true war story unless it's an anti-war story. I think you're just washing your hands of levels of complexity that actually, you know, can create incredible literature, incredible art that are fundamental to, you know, who we are as humans. So if it seems as though I'm not coming down on one side or another, it's actually just more because I'm trying to explore, like, that complexity.
What is?
Yeah, like, what is that? Like, what is that complexity that makes someone, that makes, you know, there are a lot of guys I could point to and talk to, and you would, you know, they would recount to you the day of some battle they were involved in. That was like, you know, I have those moments, there were seminal moments in my life, and they, if I'm honest, it's like, this day was the best day of my life, and it was also the worst day of my life. You know, and what does that mean, that your best day and your worst day are actually the exact same? I don't know.
Thank you.
Talk about why you chose to write fiction rather than nonfiction.
Okay. Thanks, spooky man in green coat. You know, I think that there's a whole level of truth that you can get out in fiction that you can't get to in nonfiction. There's certain things that can only be said in a story. And I think that particularly with people who have experienced the war, sometimes it's very difficult. You know, I felt, some people said, well, you should write a memoir about a certain time in your military career. And I'm like, okay, well, if I write a memoir, it can't be true. Because if I really lay everything out, the complete truth with the, you know, the dirt and the grit and everything, it's, I'll be betraying a certain trust that was vested in me. And if I hold back, it's not going to be a book that's worth anything. So for me, it was always trying to wrestle, like, you know, kind of the truth of a certain experience. And the only way I could see to get to that was through fiction. But that's not this book. That's actually a different book. Anyone else?
I can bring you back to the world of nonfiction for a minute, mm-hmm. and your current day job. I mean, can you talk to us a little bit about the Syrian conflict and, you know, what your experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan have brought to help you understand what's going on in Syria and especially sure. what the U.S. might do?
Yeah, sure. I think one of the things that's very interesting about the you know, I live in Istanbul. I spent a lot of time on the Turkish-Syrian border. And I think one of the things that's very interesting about the war is it's really, I mean, it's a continuation of the Iraq war. I mean, it's like we declared the war over, but, you know, they didn't get the memo. So what's also been interesting to see is I've made, you know, I've formed a number of relationships and, you know, become friends with people, you know, who were democratic activists in Syria's revolution. And as we've spent time with one another along the border, traveling together, talking, it's sort of, to me, it was a surprising conclusion that, you know, I've reached, which is that we're veterans of the same war. Me and a Syrian democratic activist, in so much as the forces that hijacked our causes, however you want to define them, you know, the sort of somewhat naive, but idealistic cause of bringing, you know, a just and free democratic Iraq in 2003 to the idealistic causes of creating a democratic government in Syria in 2011, you know, the forces that really hijacked that and undercut it are the same forces that have, you know, establish the Islamic State, that are, you know, bringing a lot of the difficulties to those regions right now. So what to me was unexpected was the fact that, you know, me, a former American Marine, would be sitting next to a democratic activist who is Syrian, and we would feel like we had come through very much the same experience. So that was surprising.
You see any way out of it?
Short answer, not for a long time. I think the region is going through an existential crisis right now, and I think what you're seeing are issues at play, Sunni versus Shia, that relegate us as, you know, the U.S. and the West. We're sort of, I think, tangential actors. Like, this isn't really about us. This is about them, and they're working something out, and we'll play a role in how that gets worked out. But I do think it's going to be up to them to work it out, and hopefully it's worked out with less blood instead of more.
Hey, Elliot. We're so proud of you. Now that we've turned the corner from fiction to talking about policy, let me ask you, I think, what is probably on the minds of a lot of people. The United States is going to have to decide whether we stay in Afghanistan for a year, for 2 years, will we extend beyond 2016. Based on what you've learned about Afghanistan, its culture, what you present in the book, which I started reading today, it's wonderful, what advice do you have? I mean, does it make a difference if the United States stays
in Afghanistan?
Well,
I think if we look at recent events in Iraq, I think it should give it seems as though it has given us pause to having a rapid exit out of Afghanistan. I think that's why you've seen what at least seemed to be some kind of curtailing of really dramatic troop withdrawals out of there, because I don't think anyone wants to see Afghanistan go the way of Iraq. And again, I think it's what do those troops give you? If you leave those troops there, it's not about the 5,000 troops that are sitting in Afghanistan. I think in many respects, or the 10,000 that might have been sitting in Iraq, it's about what they represent and about the United States continue to have a vested interest in the region. So I think you'll see a much slower withdrawal from Afghanistan. What's interesting, friends of mine who are still in Afghanistan, I'm actually surprised they're much more optimistic than I would have thought. I've heard a pretty consistent refrain that people think like the center is going to hold in Afghanistan and it's might be all right in the long run. So, that would be nice. But I think we would be foolhardy and conceited not to look at what's happened in Iraq the last 4 years and take some very hard lessons from that, because it could have been probably played a little bit better.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks. Anybody want to go get wings next door?
Live at Politics and Prose is a co-production of The Bookstore and Slate.com. For information about upcoming Politics and Prose events, visit politics-prose.com. And please let us know what you think of this program. Our email is podcasts@slate.com.